could access no water underneath their land without recourse?
No, not at all, for two reasons. Under Chapter 36, which is what we operate in our district, our districts are authorized to impose spacing requirements and production limits. When someone gets a permit from the district, we do impose production limits. They are designed to serve two goals: to prevent waste and to protect correlative rights. There's been a lot of discussion in the briefs as to whether there is correlative rights in underground water anymore. And our position is that as a result of Chapter 36, yes, there are. And
you need... Is the concept of correlative rights inconsistent with your theory of a vested property right to all the water underneath your land?
No more so than it is with regard to the oil and gas law. And this court has addressed that subject many times. The water code itself grants adjoining landowners a private cause of action for illegal drainage. If I pump water from my land in violation of my permit, or if I waste, the adjoining landowner can sue me under the water code for illegal drainage. That is correlative rights.
Would you compare and contrast the asserted takings here with the zoning laws of Texas?
Yes. First of all, with regard to zoning laws, there's several differences. Zoning cannot be such that you are required to immediately cease an existing application. That happens under this act.
Not if the date's moved.
I beg your pardon?
Not if the date's moved.
If the dates are moved, that still occurs.
How does it occur then?
Well, for example, this court received, I guess, yesterday or day before yesterday, some proposed rules that would supposedly address the date problem. If the court takes a look at those rules, you will see that it is still proposed to keep the June 1st, 1993 cutoff date for existing or new wells in there. In other words, under the rules that this court is told will solve the date problem, you still don't get a permit if that well was drilled after June 1st of 1993. So even addressing the date problem in the way that the appellants and those on its side say they would, you still have a retroactivity problem.
Do your districts know how many wells have been drilled since then?
There was testimony to that effect in the case, Your Honor, and there may even be a finding. I have to tell you, I cannot remember that number.
It's greater than zero.
It is greater than zero.
Are the other two zoning points then? The other two ways this is different than
zoning cannot completely, it's not a zoning regulation doesn't have to completely eliminate or destroy a property right in order to be either invalid or to require compensation. It's not required that there be indeed a physical invasion of the land. The test that the courts apply under this court's direction is a test of reasonableness. Now, if the court looks at what is happening under this act, and you look at it from a zoning perspective, it makes people stop existing uses. It limits their present uses. The best example of that from the record is the pecan orchard that has a present use and that would have to cut back significantly under the act, even under an historical use standard, such that pecan trees would die. That is not a permissible zoning act without compensation. We really are comfortable with the zoning test to the statute once one understands what the act does. We are comfortable with application of oil and gas law and the principles developed under oil and gas law once one understands what happens under this statute. And although we strongly believe that the dates cannot change, we think the result does not change. It is still unconstitutional. It is still retroactive. It still violates due process, even if the dates are changed.
Let me ask you about vested property rights in this water. What case law, what law do you rely upon to conclude that underground water that's never been utilized at all by non-historic users constitutes a vested property right.
First of all, this court has held on several occasions that the right of capture is a vested right. The right of capture itself, and that right of capture exists regardless of whether one has ever exercised that right. If one accepts the proposition, and we certainly think it is a correct proposition, that the landowner owns the corpus of the water under the land, you own it whether you choose to use it today or not. And so, unlike the surface water situations, where the state owns the water and all it gives is a right to use, which implies, as this court held, no right of non-use, where you own the corpus of the water, where you own it yourself, you don't lose it by not using it, any more so than I don't lose any piece of my property by not walking around on it once every 4 years or putting a fence around it. It's still my property, even if I choose to let it lie fallow.
What cases do you rely upon establishing that a property owner owns the corpus of the water under the land?
I would first of all cite the court to one of co-counsel for the appellants, Professor Johnson. We gave an extended quote from one of his law review articles where he discusses.
What cases do you rely on?
East. The Comanche Springs case. Some of the Court of Appeals cases, including Kickapoo.
Thanks.
Could the legislature have declared this an underground river and declared the water to be owned by the state?
Could it have?
Yes.
We think that it perhaps could have done so, but like what happened in the state of Kansas, it would have probably required that those who thought they owned that water and who under the law did own that water would have to be paid for it.
This court's interpretation in 1904, adoption of the English rule, gave a vested property right.
Yes.
That could be compensated.
Yes.
The rights that you are arguing in defense of today are not yours, but the landowners out there. Is that
true? That is correct.
In fact, none of the issues that you raise impact any right of the Bonita County district. Is that true?
Except for possibly
attorney's fees.
Just a second. I must disagree with the latter proposition. If the property is taken, if land values do decrease, certainly that reduces our tax base. We're an ad valorem taxation district. And so to the extent property values go down, it affects our revenue. That in itself, I think, is sufficient to give us standing. But even independent of that, we are a governmental entity elected by the people. Our purpose is to protect their correlative rights in the aquifer. This action, more than any other, advances that interest.
The authority has some of the same constituents.
It does, and we're not challenging their standing.
So we have constituents of two agencies of the state arguing about a state statute.
It is not unusual.
To what extent does the Texas Constitution state, imply, or argue that this water, in essence, is either the state's water or within the state's ability to regulate in such a way that it's done here? In other words, are we in essence saying that the Constitution is unconstitutional?
No, we're not. First of all, the property right itself is derived from the common law, which was adopted when we became a republic, and of course, which is preserved through the Constitution. I think, however, what the Justice is asking is, what about the Conservation Amendment?
Right.
Our position is, and this has been confirmed by the court in Brown and Corzelius and several of the other cases, just because the state is given the power, indeed the duty, to conserve these natural resources, doesn't mean it can take, reach out and take private property. Yes, it can regulate it. That's what we do. But that regulation has limits, as does the police power. This statute has crossed the line of permissive regulation. It affects the taking.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
May I please report? Mostly I've thrown out most of my notes here as I tried to listen to your questions and hopefully can continue Mr. McCullough's efforts to answer your questions and any others you may have about our other reply points to the points of error raised by appellants in this case. I do want to try to answer, start by trying to answer some of those which deal with what exactly do we believe this legislation does and what is its most serious defect. We start with the premise that we in this state and this country can do anything we want to with our property, so long as we don't hurt our neighbor or another person. When we hurt our neighbor, when we hurt the public by our use of property, the state may step in and regulate. They may step in and regulate without paying us. And what the courts have done is called this preventing harm to the public.
When you say though the test to be applied here as to whether or not the state can regulate this is the rational relation test.
I would agree. Well, Your Honor, we think this is a fundamental right. And
what case law, what type of legal authority do you rest your argument that this is a fundamental right?
The City of Sherman case, for example, called this the water rights at issue here an exclusive and fundamental right. Now, I would differ with Mr. McCullough about the nature of the right. I think it is more a right to seek and obtain water under the land. But the fact that it's a right to seek and obtain doesn't mean that the right doesn't vest until you actually take the water. Otherwise, oil and gas law, you'd never have anyone entering into oil and gas leases because they wouldn't have a present right for which to grant a mineral.
So you're saying that we should not apply the rational relation test but the compelling interest test?
That's correct. We do think, however, that this statute fails under the rational relation test for a number of reasons. It's both under-inclusive as to some factors and over-inclusive as to others. The primary problem with it, though, is what this statute does is try to redefine the very nature of the property right. And it's the way it does this and the way it shifts the burden to the landowner from the government that is a primary concern. You asked earlier about, you know, how does this really differ from Chapter 36? Under Chapter 36, what happens is the government may regulate if and when the need arises. If and when there is a serious drought condition and everyone's pumping might endanger everyone in the community, then existing underground water conservation districts can come in and take action to prevent a harm. What this statute does is shift the burden to the landowner to prove their use. It creates a presumption that there is no right unless you apply for and are granted that right.
Let me ask you this. Are there conclusive fact findings? And when I say conclusive in the sense that it's unequivocal, there's no way around it, at the trial court level, that there is no conservation need?
I'm sorry, that there is no
conservation need.
I think there were conclusive findings in the trial court that there is not currently a crisis situation justifying imposing a current cap on pumping. And that's where, again, that gets back to this idea. I think the state characterized this act as a drought management plan writ large, is the term the state used. That's exactly what the problem is. This statute assumes that if a drought occurs, spring flows will stop at the Comal Springs. But what the findings of the trial court showed, as Mr. McCullough pointed out, are that there is sufficient water in this aquifer for everyone, for users, existing users, even if spring flow stops. During the drought in the
50s... Let me ask you a question. We've said on any number of occasions we're not here to assess the wisdom of what the legislature did.
And we agree.
So I'm not sure it's really relevant to be arguing whether or not this actually accomplishes what the legislature wanted to do. And it seems to me that the water district's points here are... I mean, you seem to argue that the state needs to have some sort of... meet some sort of constitutional test for regulating water, but that's water under the bridge. They regulate water. The only issue I see that's pertinent in any of this is under the new act, people who otherwise had an expectation of a right to access water now no longer have that right. And it seems to me that's a property deprivation issue. This is not an invasion of privacy or some sort of invasion of a protected individual interest. It seems to me this is simply a property right. And following up on Justice Cornyn's question, the Constitution specifically provides the government can take your property.
That's correct.
The solution is that you get paid for it. Why isn't the answer in all of this litigation is to wait until some individual who owns a property right finds it taken by the authority and they sue for the failure of the state to compensate them? And irrespective, I don't think we rely on whether or not the government allocates just X dollars to an authority over here as whether or not it pays. It seems to me constitutionally, whatever the value of that property right is, the government's got to pay for it. So now, why don't we just tell the authority, go about doing your business, and when somebody comes forward and claims that their property has been taken, at that point, then the courts become involved and determine whether constitutionally compensation is required. Why isn't that really what's going on here?
Your Honor, we believe that the statute on its face affects the taking now, partially because of the absolute cutoff, the March 1st, 1994 date. You cannot get a well under the express terms of the statute unless you have applied to use your property right.
So why don't we have a litigant here who has made an application and, I mean, who wants to drill a well and they have been prohibited from doing so?
In fact, Your Honor, there was testimony that no one could apply because the district did not exist as of the deadline. And therefore, it was literally impossible for anyone to meet that deadline. There were no forms.
So is there someone here who has brought a claim saying, I would like to make an application and I can't because I don't have any place to put it?
There was testimony in the trial court. There is not an individual named plaintiff. However, we do have representational standing on behalf of the property owners in our district to make that claim. In addition, the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association also has representational standing to make that claim on behalf of their members. And I believe, I may be incorrect in this, and I hope my co-counsel will correct me, but I believe that one of the named appellees did in fact attempt to make application the Russell Cattle Company. So there is someone, I believe there was testimony in the statement of fact in the record that an effort was made, but there was no form, no place, no agency to whom to make the application.
Were they prevented from drilling a well?
They were prevented from complying with the terms of the statute, and the statute creates an absolute prohibition on pumping unless they have done so, unless they have made proper application as of March 1st, 1994.
But the statute has not been applied.
Only because the trial court restrained its enforcement from being applied.
But that's what you wanted done, wasn't it?
Yes, we wanted it restrained, absolutely. We don't believe that a litigant has to wait until an unconstitutional statute is applied to him, her, or it before that litigant may challenge that statute in court.
Facially.
Yes, facially.
I mean, that is constitutional law. You can only challenge facially unless you absolutely have a claim going, isn't that right?
We do.
Does Russell say we're attacking this as applied to us in this case, in these briefs?
No.
All right. Can you argue that at all?
Can
you argue Russell's position?
Can I?
Or can they if they're not making an application claim?
They cannot argue that you owe me X dollars because you have taken my property.
Right, so that gets back to the very first question. We have only a facial attack on the act as it exists.
We disagree with that. We believe we sustained our burden of showing that as applied, this statute would clearly cut off some property owners' rights absolutely.
But as long if you're making a takings claim, you haven't been constitutionally injured until you've been denied compensation, have you?
If you are making a, if you are trying to gain compensation under Article 1, Section 17, no, you cannot say my property has been taken, give me my just compensation. But you can obtain injunctive relief to prevent a taking if you show that government action will affect the taking. And that's why we can't.
But the government can take your property. You just have to pay for it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I did want to point out to the court that the compensation provisions that have been asked about and discussed here are not, in fact, compensation provisions. What happens here is the nature of the right has been redefined, and those who have a current vested property right have to apply to the government to obtain it.
But if I can interject, you said the nature of the vested right of these landowners is to seek and acquire the water under their property.
Yes.
Unless they actually seek and attempt to acquire the water and there's no water to acquire for some reason, they haven't been injured, have they, under your theory of the vested right?
They've been deprived of the right to drill for them. They have been deprived of the right
but
for to
those who,
the water.
But for those who are using their property for non-agricultural purposes and who don't seek to drill a well, how have they been injured?
They cannot lease to someone else the right to seek water under their land.
Maybe they have no interest in doing so. Doesn't your theory of the case necessitate our assumption that every landowner affected by this legislation will either seek to drill a well or be denied a permit or otherwise be injured?
It's our position that a party doesn't have to actually exercise a right to have it taken away from them. Mr. McCullough's example, we may have raw land southwest of Austin. We may have no current intention of developing it. It may be land we've inherited from our family. It may be the only property we own. If the state comes in and says, that land will be parkland, not the analogy of, well, you may have a hope to build a shopping center. We're not going to let you do that. We'll let you build a residence. What's happened here is the state has come in and said, you may not build. That land is going to be a public park. If I have made no effort to develop that land, I nevertheless have had my property taken. If the government is requiring that that land not be used, not be developed, I have been deprived by the effect of a law saying it shall be a park. I've been deprived then of a valuable property right.
Let me ask you this, consistent with that. The buyers or owners of the platted property may never have any desire to drill a well. And because they may never have a desire to drill a well, they may not have been injured in any way yet. Is it a valid argument? And if so, you're going to have to explain it to me. Is it a valid argument that on the face of the legislation, owners of property have been injured because it automatically reduces the value of their property, even for those who may never want to drill a well.
Yes, and there was ample testimony about the difference in the value of property with water and without water.
So in other words, with the enactment of the act, with the effectiveness of the act itself, without anybody desiring to drill a well or anything like that, and based upon what was found at the trial court, have property owners been injured even without deciding whether or not they're ever going to drill a well?
Yes, Your Honor. And we believe that there was testimony that they were injured even in anticipation of the bill becoming effective. There simply was, there's a reduction in any desire to develop property, and that was part of the explanation for why certain people hadn't sought permits under the bill, because of an anticipation that they would not be able to sell their property.
This is a facial challenge. Mr. Potter suggested that it would be within the authorities' purview to promulgate rules protecting correlative rights, meaning they could set up rules that unitize water interests or pool water interests so that whatever water I have under my property, if I'm subjected to a spacing requirement or I can't drill a well here, that I can participate in the will. The revenue achieved from the well next door, or have an interest in the water that's pulled out of the well next door, and they could do rules like that, effectively overruling East, but at least making it consistent with what we do with oil and gas. Would that, if your interest is protected by this pooling or unitization, does that solve the facial unconstitutional challenge here?
No, because that's not what the statute lets them do. Potter characterized the EAA as a water bank. But if you actually look at the funding mechanism in Section 1.29, what it allows is once someone proves they are entitled to a permit, once if they manage to meet the March 1st deadline, if they have drilled a well by June 1st, 1993, if they manage to get a permit, then the funding mechanism allows the EAA to come in and retire existing permits. People who have not been able to meet their burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence, which is the burden the statute imposes on them to prove their right to their existing property rights. If they're not able to do that, if they haven't met those deadlines, they are not even allowed to participate in that funding mechanism. That funding mechanism he described only allows the EAA to repurchase permits, to acquire permits. And it may then redistribute the water. There are a few mechanisms that allow people to use conservation measures and increase the amount of their permits. But as far as buying and selling, we would disagree that there is a common pool and that money goes back to the property owners. One, it only goes to those people who have a permit, which we think is impossible for them to do. In addition, in Section 1.29, there is an absolute, there's a limit, one, that the authority can't collect certain amounts unless they are reasonably necessary to administer the authority. And there is a limitation on fees assessed, and fees assessed on downstream water rights holders may not exceed one-half of the cost of permit retirements from 450,000 acre feet a year, or an adjusted amount as determined under the statute. So there's a limit on what they can collect, and we think what they can use that money for. So we would disagree with the characterization. And I see I'm out of time.
I have one question. Your answer to Justice Abbott's query seemed to be that the mere reduction in the value of property or potential resale, even if your personal use hadn't been impacted at all, is a constitutional taking. How does that square with our repeated rulings on eminent domain?
A mere diminution in value is not in and of itself a taking. But if a diminution in value, say for example the contrary example, there is ample evidence in the trial court that 25,000, the 25,000 limit doesn't apply if your property happens to be a pecan farm.
Well, I wasn't, I was talking about your, not that, but your answer to Justice Abbott's question about the owner of a plat in a subdivision, or a lot in a subdivision, who did not intend to drill a well, ever.
I think I understand.
And you, I believe, said that there was a constitutional taking.
The reason there's a taking here is you look at property as a bundle of rights, but because water, like oil and gas, can be severed, what's happened with this statute is a taking of 100% of the value of the water. It's not just a diminution of the value of the surface. It is 100% of that water right. Yes, it is part of the bundle of sticks that make up property rights. But because of its unique nature, taking all of the water rights isn't just a diminution of value. It is a complete and total taking. And that's why we believe that there is an as-applied argument here, and that we sustain that argument properly.
Any other questions?
Two more. One. Explain your basis for your claim that the Act requires a prepayment of an administrative penalty before the Court of Appeal, before a court appeal could be taken.
Our concern there is that, well, one, we don't think the statute lets you appeal it. There's no provision in the statute that allows an appeal to district court, and we think that makes it constitutionally defective to begin with. But there are also penalty provisions. If someone drills a well, and the statute says they're not authorized to, and these folks out here right now risk being hit with civil penalties, before the one provision, the only provision in the Act that allows an appeal deals with the assessment of civil penalties, and it says that the penalties must be paid before you can go to district court to challenge what the agency has done. Now, those kinds of schemes, if they allow for the filing of affidavits of inability to pay, have been upheld. But what has happened here, again, is because of the nature of the right and the fact that we don't believe the aquifer authority can adjudicate that right, that by shifting the burden to the property owner, again, what they have done is, in effect, a denial of due process because of the nature of the right and the shifting of the burden. If we were talking about you have a license to practice law and the state is assessing a penalty and you must pay that penalty prior to appealing a decision on your license, we'd have a different situation. And I think that's why the Texas Association of Business case can be distinguished from what we're arguing here.
Okay. And now the tough one.
I thought that one was tough.
In modern day Texas, how can you defend the continued application of the English rule?
If the state of Texas wants to decide that we as a state no longer want to allow the rule capture, then we as a state can change prospectively property rights. So the people who purchase property in the future will know that they no longer have a right to groundwater. But for those who have an existing right before a bill actually cuts off that right, they have to be compensated. Well, so can the state do it? Yes, the state can do it. But they haven't done it with this bill.
So you're not defending the English rule prospectively.
Well, that would be a policy. And we don't deny that the legislature can come in and say, Texas, we don't want you to have this property right anymore. We're going to take it away from you. We're saying that they have to, if someone already has that property right, if that property right is vested, as it has for all those people who own land in Texas, you can't take it away without paying for it. But prospectively, if the state wants to say, we decided it's a bad idea, and they want to pay for those rights or come out and buy the land, of course the state has the authority to do that.
Any other questions?
Going to take a lot more than this to other bills.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. I have a few comments, and then I'll defer to my colleague, Mr. Rogers.
The first thing that I wanted to discuss is what I think has been a fundamental misconception on the part of the plaintiffs below, and that is the idea that somehow the English rule or the rule of capture is somehow some sort of absolute right not subject to any reasonable regulation. This court has made clear since 1904 in the East case that absent positive legislation that the English rule would be the rule. There is no vested property right in the water itself under its land because the rule of capture is not to capture your own water, but essentially in the East case it was the right to capture your neighbor's water. And it is a rule of non-liability. And what we are hearing today is a conversion of a rule of non-liability into somehow a rule of an absolute right to capture water for one's own use, irrespective of any legislation. That flies contrary to 92 years of case law out of this court. It has always been subject to reasonable regulation by the state. And what we heard today is the one exception to getting a well is a subdivision requirement. As we sit here today in my lot in North Austin, I cannot drill a well because of zoning regulations on my lot to withdraw water. Does that mean that my property has been taken? Absolutely not.
But you knew that when you purchased your property.
That's correct.
In other words, what they're arguing is it would be as if you, when you bought your property, you could have drilled that well, but then they come in and put new deed restrictions in that prohibit you, which in essence takes away that right from you.
And that limited, narrow circumstance is also the situation that these very districts have. Under Chapter 36, the Medina and Uvalde districts, as well as other Chapter 36 districts, have the power to deny permits based upon spacing requirements. And the platted subdivision requirement is nothing more than a spacing requirement. You can still apply for a permit. You don't get the automatic exemption is the only key there.
Under that act, under the water code or under the Medina or Uvalde Water District, who defines what the spacing requirements are?
I believe it's by administrative rules. They decide what the spacing is going to be. And I think that the legislature had reasonable intentions in mind when they were concerned about an owner of a large parcel of land subdividing it simply to acquire a bunch of water rights. They wanted this truly to be an exemption and not some sort of ability to commercially exploit what was supposed to be an exemption for smaller wells. But I want to bring that back to the larger point. The larger point here is there's been, I think, too much focus on one aspect of the bundle of sticks. Ms. Riggs hit it exactly right when she said that the property right in water is but one bundle of sticks in property ownership. It is one aspect. And that is where the zoning analogy hits home once again. All that is being regulated is the use of that water. It is not that you cannot use that property for any reason. And that is why this is very similar to a zoning restriction. In fact, the example that I just gave, my lot here in Austin, I cannot drill a well, but that's just one aspect of ownership. That doesn't mean that there's been a destruction of the value of my property. Keeping in mind also that under the takings laws and under the regulation of the state's police power, the state has the right to come in and take that property, even if you said the whole bundle of, that water rights were the whole bundle of sticks. The state still has that right, provided that in the balancing of interests, the interest of the landowner versus the common good, that balancing favors the state. And certainly that is what's happened here. There are 1.5 million users of Edwards Aquifer water that are dependent on that resource for a sole source of water. And I think what the legislature has done here is balance those interests versus what we are talking about is very minute exceptions to the rule. The subdivision, these few people that may have fallen into this little gap are going to have to stand in line to apply for a different type of permit. We're not saying that they're cut off absolutely. That is mere speculation on the part of the plaintiffs, that there will not be rights available, that the EAA will not make permitted rights available. And then we assume that there was somehow some absolute right to capture. That the court has been clear since the very beginning in the East case that the right to capture is subject to positive legislation. In fact, the court's last major writing on this subject was in 1978 in the Friendswood case. And the court held that the need for additional legislation for creation of districts to cover unregulated groundwater reservoirs and to solve other conflicts which may arise in this area of water law and subsidence seemed to be inevitable. Providing policy and regulatory procedures in this field
is a legislative function. It is well that the legislature has assumed its proper role, because our courts are not equipped to regulate groundwater uses and subsidence on a suit-by-suit basis. And that is precisely what the legislature has done in this case. In accordance with the precedent established by this court since the East case in 1904 through the Friendswood case in 1978, the legislature acted in enacting the EAA in a constitutional manner consistent with principles articulated in the Constitution. And keep in mind that what we are balancing here is a common law right, the rule of capture, which this court has said is subject to the legislative will, and that was prior to the enactment of the Conservation Amendment. And somehow the argument seems to be that we have the common law swallowing the Constitution.
Let me ask you this. What about their argument that for us to uphold this as constitutional, we, the court, will in essence have to be amending the Act to include some new dates, to include a right to appeal and some other things like that, and to include whether or not the permit runs with the land?
Well, one, there is no need to determine, let me go backwards, whether the permits run with the land. I think that there are already legal concepts that cover that, and certainly there are express provisions concerning the purchase of water rights. I think that's a matter of interpretation for the authority, not for this court. Second, as far as amending the dates, the only thing that this court needs to do with respect to the filing deadlines is simply say that due to impossibility of performance, the dates are directory. That allows the authority to come up with reasonable dates. And as far as the administrative review provisions, those are right in the statute. We don't have to assume that the legislature wanted the APA to apply. The legislature told us what they intended. They intended for the Administrative Procedures Act to apply. And to say otherwise would reach an absurd result, and to assume that the legislature put that language in there for no reason. But in closing, the legislature acted in a constitutional manner consistent with principles articulated in the Conservation Amendment to the Texas Constitution and consistent with principles articulated by this court over the last 92 years. For these reasons, the state of Texas respectfully requests that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court and render a judgment affirming the constitutionality of the Edwards Aquifer Authority Act. Thank you.
Roger, do you contend that it's an all-or-nothing proposition, or provisions of this statute severable?
That's a good question, Justice Cornyn. The vast majority of the complaints that are directed at this legislation deal with one aspect of the Act, and that is the part of the Act that talks about permitting so that the water use can be fit within an overall cap. There are many other provisions of the Act, tools in the box, of tools available to the Edwards Aquifer Authority to improve the situation in Central Texas. The permitting provisions that are complained of here are only a part of that. If those provisions were unconstitutional, those provisions can be stricken, should be stricken, so that the remainder of the Act can go forward. Bear in mind that the Edwards Aquifer Authority, this entity on the map, at the very least has all the powers of a Chapter 52 district, the same powers that the districts attacking it have. And the legislature has determined that they would rather deal with this problem regionally rather than with continue dealing with smaller turf wars that keep going on.
Mr. Rogers, I don't know, maybe this isn't relevant at all, but it seems to me that under the individual districts that existed, one of the points was that it really balanced interests among users, this user and that user and that sort of thing. And basically what happened is if somebody asserted that their neighbor was using up more water than they could reasonably use, they were wasting it, then you had certain causes of action that existed out there. If one person's use of water actually resulted in physical damage to the neighbor, there was some sort of cause of action that transferred the funds from one side to the other. An underlying argument that's going on here is that what this new district does is for the sake of the whole, it now limits an individual's use of their property, not because they're wasting it, but in fact to say, you're going to have to let your pecan orchard die, because we have made a policy decision that something else needs to be protected. One of the briefs talks about there's plenty of water in the reservoir for all the human beings in San Antonio to drink, but we don't want the minnows to die. If that's the public policy decision that the state makes, can the state say that you can't drink water out of your well today? You can drink it tomorrow. Maybe you can drink it 5 days from now, but today you can't drink that water of your well. Can the state say that without that being a taking for public purpose?
The first point I'd make.
That language in there for no reason. But in closing, the legislature acted in a constitutional manner consistent with principles articulated in the conservation amendment to the Texas Constitution and consistent with principles articulated by this court over the last 92 years. For these reasons, the state of Texas respectfully requests that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court and render a judgment affirming the constitutionality of the Edwards Aquifer Authority Act. Thank you.
Mr. Rogers, do you contend that it's an all-or-nothing proposition or provisions of this statute severable?
That's a good question, Justice Cornyn. The vast majority of the complaints that are directed at this legislation deal with one aspect of the Act, and that is the part of the Act that talks about permitting so that the water use can be fit within an overall cap. There are many other provisions of the Act, tools in the box, of tools available to the Edwards Aquifer Authority to improve the situation in Central Texas. The permitting provisions that are complained of here are only a part of that. If those provisions were unconstitutional, those provisions can be stricken, should be stricken, so that the remainder of the Act can go forward. Bear in mind that the Edwards Aquifer Authority, this entity on the map, at the very least has all the powers of a Chapter 52 district, the same powers that the districts attacking it have. And the legislature has determined that they would rather deal with this problem regionally rather than with continue dealing with smaller turf wars that keep going on.
Mr. Rogers, let me, I don't know, maybe this isn't relevant at all, but it seems to me that under the individual districts that existed, one of the points was that it really balanced interests among users, this user and that user and that sort of thing. And basically what happened is if somebody asserted that their neighbor was using up more water than they could reasonably use, they were wasting it, then you had certain causes of action that existed out there. If one person's use of water actually resulted in physical damage to the neighbor, there was some sort of cause of action that transferred the funds from one side to the other. An underlying argument that's going on here is that what this new district does is for the sake of the whole. It now limits an individual's use of their property, not because they're wasting it, but in fact to say, you're going to have to let your pecan orchard die because we have made a policy decision that something else needs to be protected. One of the briefs talks about there's plenty of water in the reservoir for all the human beings in San Antonio to drink, but we don't want the minnows to die. If that's the public policy decision that the state makes, can the state say that you can't drink water out of your well today? You can drink it tomorrow. Maybe you can drink it 5 days from now, but today you can't drink that water of your well. Can the state say that without that being a taking for public purpose?
The first point I'd make, Your Honor, is that, of course, we have to remember that we have the exempt well provisions in here. If you need to drink water, you can drill a well and take up 25,000 gallons a day.
Do you have to get a permit to get that exempt?
No, Your Honor.
You just can drill.
You just can do it.
So you're saying that
it's a safety net is what it is.
All these people out there can drill now without fear of the penalties.
They can drill an exempt well.
As long as
for domestic purposes and livestock purposes.
But
what about the comp?
If I could answer,
I'm sorry.
Whether or not a pecan farmer would be required to let his trees die
is a matter for an administrative proceeding in the future. Once the Edward Doctors Authority has had a chance to go through the process and consider his application and determine whether to grant him a variance or to provide some other exception. That's a case for another day.
But if it's not waste, but if it is not waste, and they need more than 25,000, whatever it is,
yes,
water, and I don't know. But if it's not waste, but the government just says, we know this is what you've had and this is what you've used, but because somebody else down the road, we prefer that they have access to it over you having this access, we're going to transfer your access to them. Is that not some sort of taking this compensable?
If I may paraphrase your question as I understand it, I believe you're asking, can the legislature regulate a region to achieve an overall public benefit while causing some burden to individuals? I think the answer to that question is yes. I think in the Turtle Rock case, this court chose to take a very holistic approach to the taking analysis. And that is, first of all, we determine whether the legislation is a reasonable attempt to achieve some legitimate purpose, number one. The second prong is, does the property right involved, does the public benefit derived from the legislation exceed the burdens that are suffered by individuals? In other words, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Is the region better off, notwithstanding the fact that some individuals may have some limitations on their exercise of their use of property in the past? And I think the answer to that question, if the court reaches the taking issue in this case, the answer to that question is no, there is not a taking. This is regulation. There may be some effect on land values, but this court for many years has recognized that that is a necessary attribute of exercising the police power.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.
All right.